Hi everyone, welcome to Chinese Whispers. This is where we demystify the People's Republic of China. I'm a foreign policy enthusiast interested in understanding China. In this episode, I interview Saleh Hudayar over Skype. He's an Uyghur activist who is also the Prime Minister of the East Turkestan government in exile. Hi everyone, today we have Saleh Hudayar, who's the Prime Minister of the East Turkestan government in exile. He's also an Uyghur activist who campaigns for the rights of the Uyghur people of East Turkestan, also known as by the Chinese colonial name as Xinjiang. So, hi Saleh, pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be on here, thank you.
Awesome. So, we have a few tough questions for him, which I hope he's going to answer. These will be covering how, you know, East Turkestan plans to get independence, what he would advise to the countries around, especially from my perspective to India. What is the overall geopolitics of the region, what type of a government he envisages, and of course his compatriots, and how does he plan to handle the issues that might arise in the government, and especially my prime focus will be on inclusivity. So let's start. So Saleh, China is kind of strong today, right? Do you see the possibility of an Uyghur insurrection, like an armed rebellion, succeeding? Like, are there any examples in history where this has worked?
Yes, in fact, that's the main reason why the Chinese government is locking up millions of people in concentration camps and prisons, is because that it fears, you know, an armed rebellion. It's because that it fears East Turkestan's independence. In fact, China's national defense strategy has stated numerous times over the past several years that one of their top national defense goals is to prevent East Turkestan's independence. Our most, you know, recent example, or let me start with the creation of the East Turkestan, the establishment of the East Turkestan Republic back in the 1930s. In 1884, the Manchu Qing dynasty had invaded and occupied East Turkestan and was renamed it to Xinjiang, meaning the new territory. By the 1920s, our people began to, develop a sense of national identity, and we declared independence in 1933. But the event that led to us declaring independence in 1933 was a wedding that happened in 1931, in which a Chinese military officer tried to marry a Uyghur woman, Uyghur girl. Her parents and her family members, rather than, you know, protesting it, they decided, you know, let's just plan something. Let's let the wedding happen. And at the day of the wedding, our people, the Chinese military officer came with 50 Chinese soldiers. And before the wedding could even initiate, they were all massacred by the Uyghurs, and their weapons were seized to start this rebellion. By 1932, Uyghurs in Khotan, which is near India's border, actually, overran the armory in Khotan and seized a lot of Chinese weapons and used it to overthrow, you know, the Chinese government administration in East Turkestan. And they declared the Khotan government, which served as the precursor to the East Turkestan Republic, that was declared on November 12, 1933. The only reason our government didn't last too long, East Turkestan Republic didn't last too long, was because of Soviet intervention. The Chinese occupation forces were not able to crush the rebellion on their own, and so they required assistance from the Soviets by getting, the Soviets intervened via airplanes, tanks, and other armored vehicles to crush and overthrow the East Turkestan Republic. During that, from 1934 to 1944, East Turkestan was ruled by a Chinese nationalist warlord who, during his period, engaged in atrocities much similar to what is happening today, in which he arrested and purged and killed over 200,000 of our people, including intellectuals, scholars, religious clergy, and so forth, and businessmen and women. In 1944, we declared independence once more on November 12th, 1944. But the rebellion that broke out was actually 5 days prior on November 7th. Several hundred Uyghurs, you know, armed with some improvised weapons, some rifles, and mainly swords, attacked Chinese military, Chinese police station in Ghulja and overtook it. By the end of that day, they had seized, you know, much of the government buildings and other police stations across the city, despite the fact there were, you know, several divisions of Chinese troops, KMT troops stationed out there. The KMT, you know, didn't resist after, especially after we took over an airbase, and they were waiting on reinforcements to fight against us. But by the time their reinforcements came, our numbers had swelled into the thousands, and we had acquired assistance from the Soviet Union.
Wow. Wow. So a bunch of, like, you know, initially unarmed Uyghur people freaked out a few divisions of the KMT. Is that correct?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Can you tell us more about some recent examples?
So another recent example was like the last time that we had a large scale or semi-large scale armed uprising was in 1990, in April 5th, 1990, in the town of Baran. And this was essentially what started off as a peaceful demonstration to protest the Chinese government's forced abortion policies, the forced abortion of 250 Uyghur babies in that town. Resulted, you know, in a crackdown by the government, the Chinese government, in which they sent security forces. And rather than our people, you know, submitting, they said, you know, if we're going to die, let's at least die fighting back against these Chinese communists. And so they revolted, captured their weapons, and by the Chinese government sent in, you know, 22,000 troops to, you know, crush this small rebellion of less than several hundred armed people. And those wow. arms were actually from the Chinese soldiers that they had captured. And the Chinese government wasn't able to crush it immediately. So rather than facing, you know, direct, you know, ground military confrontation, which would only mean that the Chinese security forces, they feared that they would lose and that more weapons, including heavy weapons like armored vehicles, would be captured by Uyghurs and other Turkic peoples. So they instead resulted, you know, to send in air bombardments and artillery strikes to crush the rebellion.
Wow. Wow. So when there were like a few hundred Uyghurs without actual military training, they rebelled, and there were 22,000 Chinese soldiers. They still chose not to go in and actually fight, but actually send over aircrafts, so that they can just bombard and then they can claim victory over that. Is that correct?
Exactly, because again, they wow. feared that we would capture the weapons, including, you know, their armored vehicles, and use that against them. So rather than taking that risk of, you know, making the rebellion into a much more powerful, stronger rebellion, as it had been in the previous cases, they decided to just resort to armed to aircraft. Bombardment.
Wow. So the inference I get from this particular subject is that just simply arm the Uyghurs and they will take care of the rest. It's like to create the republic, just arming them should be enough, right?
Essentially, yes. That's what China fears the most. In fact, in 2009, you had a senior Chinese PLA colonel talking about this at a lecture during the at the Chinese National Defense University, in which he stated that in the event that the U.S. and China get into a conflict, it won't take long for the U.S. to arm anywhere from 300,000 to 500,000 Uyghurs. And those Uyghurs will immediately cut off our east to west pipeline, you know, the pipelines for natural gas, oil, and other resources from East Turkestan to China, which would help sustain China's, you know, efforts to wage war. And essentially, they fear that they would lose the war. So that's why he proposed that this is the biggest security issue to China, and that they need to deal with it urgently, that this is not about anti-terrorism.
Wow. Okay, that sounds good. You know, on that very note, what would you say to the Indian government in this case? Because Indian people, especially since the 1962 war, it feels like a bit of a scar on us even today. At least that's how I feel. So there's a bit of a fear about the PLA, about who they are and what they might be doing, and they come in such large numbers and they have so many fancy weapons. What would you say to them, to the Indian government in this case?
Well, see, all they have is numbers, and most of them, you know, they rather flee than actually fight if there's actual resistance. India at that time was not really well prepared. In fact, they didn't expect something like that because they made numerous, you know, treaties with China, you know, offering their goodwill. And even today, more recently, you saw this year, this past June, in which, you know, several hundred PLA forces attacked Indian forces and still unarmed Indian forces, which were, what, about 40, and still got their ass handed to them.
Yeah, that's true. That's what actually came as a surprise to many of us, that how did this become so lopsided? Like on that side, there were special forces and we had largely regular troops. And yet it was such a disbalance in our favor. But yeah, that makes a lot of sense now. So thank you for that insight, though. I mean, this is very, very important history, at least for Indian people to know. Now, let's talk about the geopolitics of the region. Now, I think East Turkestan for the last 100 years plus, like give or take, has been under the shadow of either the Soviet Union and or China. Let's assume, I mean, I hope so, that one day East Turkestan is actually an independent republic. How would the geopolitics play out? Like, what would your concerns, what would your, how, like, how would you think about geopolitics in this case?
Geopolitically, I mean, our main concern would still be China, because they would still try to, we feel that they would still try to control East Turkestan or try to instigate issues to where, you know, they will try to invade East Turkestan one way or another. In that case, you know, we would try to maintain closer ties with countries like India. India, for a long time, historically, East Turkestan and India have a long history of cultural and economic exchanges. The Soviets, Russia, you know, initially they opposed our first republic. They supported our second republic, but then ended up selling us out in 1949 in favor of China. So we still have that bad taste left from the Russian experience. However, with the India, you know, we've never had any conflict with India throughout our history. And so maintaining strong military and political and economic ties with India would be our first and foremost policy, while also, you know, maintaining closer relationships with the United States, Japan, and Europe.
Fascinating. So this would, I would say this message goes to the Indian government and at least to all the geopolitics watchers that, well, East Turkestan like kind of relies on us on many levels. So it's time we stepped up, I would say. And that's actually why we are doing the podcast in the first place. So that's a fair point. Just one small question though, like you always need seaport access for trade. What would be the best option for East Turkestan then?
Well, so in the case of East Turkestan, I think India has, since it's surrounded by the ocean, India would be the best strategic access for us in terms of seaports by working with India. I mean, obviously, we'd have a very, I envision a very close friend and friendly economic, political, and military relationship between the two countries. So getting seaport access through India would be our best option. There's also the option of, you know, Balochistan via Gwadar. You know that China is building the CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, and ultimately they're not going to be able to use it because in the end, East Turkestan is going to be an independent nation, and so we could possibly go through that route. But given Pakistan's stance on our issue, I don't think Pakistan would be too willing to allow that to happen. While also, I mean, there's other geopolitical considerations that we need to take in terms of Pakistan. It's largely unstable. It wouldn't be safe in terms of trade given the current circumstance at the moment. Mm-hmm. So India would be a better option, just connecting, you know, building roads from East Turkestan, from Khotan into Eastern Ladakh, and then via Ladakh to India and to the ports, port cities.
Yeah, that's one of my concerns, is like, because that geography is very harsh. Like, that's like 17,000 feet, etc. And it's like, even the roads are kind of thin. I don't know how exactly that's going to be managed. Again, I don't know anything about the, like, how the roads are in East Turkestan and the kind of logistical demand that will be there. But again, like, based on what my experience goes, typically you need lots of very, like, six-lane roads and stuff. That is a little doubtful in Ladakh, but let's see. I don't know. I'm not the expert on that.
Well, I mean, with the circumstances today, I mean, even if we don't have roads directly, I mean, you know, flight airplanes going via mm-hmm. airplanes, you know, that is another option. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't necessarily give us, you know, access to seaports, but that could be another option. And plus the Chinese, you know, they have been building numerous roads and in these high mountains. And many of us thought that would be, you know, not possible. But if they can do it, why wouldn't we be able to do it? Why wouldn't India, with its resources and expertise, be able to do it? You know,
I agree. We are already constructing, we're very close to finishing a railway till Kashmir. Maybe if that's possible, that could be extended all across. Let's see. I don't know. Rail connectivity might be a good idea there.
Absolutely. No. I think that would be a much easier and efficient way to do it than having to build, building six lane roads is going to be much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now let's go to the government style. It's like, what government style do you want to go for? I understand you want an open democratic republic. Would you go for a parliamentary system or a presidential system? And whose institutional help would you like to take for this?
So as far as this, historically, when we declared independence in 1933, it was a parliamentary system. In 1944, it was a presidential system based on the Soviet model, you could say. However, our current exile government, it's both, it's a mix. It's a parliamentary system mostly, but again, I think it would ultimately depend upon what our people want. Right now, it's too early to say. I think we would probably set up an interim government based on a parliamentary system for about a year, and then engage our people's thoughts on what they would want for their future state.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. And whose help would you like to take, at least in the establishment of institutions? I would say American help works, maybe. Sorry?
American help would definitely work. Again, because of India's role as the world's largest democracy, its experience and the connectivity that we have with India, it's our neighbor. I think it would be much easier to, get help from India logistically than to obtain help from the United States or even European countries for that matter.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah, my only concern would be like, India has typically been an inward looking place and doesn't want to venture out as much as, for example, China or the US have done. So let's see. I hope that day arrives. I have my fingers crossed.
Likewise.
Yeah, sounds good. So now moving on to the next section. This might be very, very controversial, but let's face it. So there's an unfortunate opinion amongst many sections of the Indian population that whenever a group of Muslims get together, a democratic system is unlikely, with rare exceptions. And it's like, if you look at pretty much most of the Muslim countries, very few are actual real democracies. Like, I think Bangladesh comes close. Or I don't know which other example to give. Like, most of them have some sort of an Islamist problem. So how would you tackle that?
So as far as this, previously our East Turkestan Republic was actually a secular republic. It separated, you know, religion from politics, while also respecting, you know, people to, you know, practice their religious, you know, whatever religion that they that they adhere to. Likewise, we envision a secular East Turkestan that respects, you know, religious freedom, but maintains a, you know, a clear line between politics and religion in terms of state matters. Turkey, you know, under Atatürk, they did an exceptional job. Atatürk did an exceptional job in maintaining, you know, the Turkish state, reforming it to be a secular model, making the military the guarantor of the secular state until more recently with the Erdogan regime. We don't have too much Islamists in our country. For historically, we've been, you know, a multi-ethnic and multi-religious people. In fact, historically, you know, Uyghurs have, you know, started off being from shaman to Buddhism to even Nestorian Christianity, and then eventually Islam became the prominent predominant religion that we see today. Even in our form of Islam, it's a mostly liberal form of Islam, Hanafi school of thought. So I don't think we will have too much problems with Islamist influence, but the key to you know, maintaining, you know, that there is minimal, or at least no, like no, it would be very impossible, but minimal to where it doesn't involve in our politics, is education, educating our people, you know, what about our own religion, about religious freedom, about democracy. And I think that that's the only way that we can truly guarantee that no Islamist regime will come to power.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. One thing which we have talked offline in other contexts, but I would still like to put this before you. Now, China talks a lot that, oh, there's an Islamism problem. There's a quote-unquote radicalism problem in East Turkestan. I mean, obviously, what they refer as Xinjiang. What do you have to say on that?
So, as far as that, there is no Islamist problem or radicalism problem. China, as I mentioned earlier, China's biggest fear is that it will lose control of East Turkestan. You know, up until 9/11 happened, China would never label Uyghurs as terrorists. We were always labeled as counter-revolutionaries, foreign devils, ethnic nationalists, separatists, etc. However, 9/11 happened, and in fact, 2 weeks before 9/11, the Chinese government in East Turkestan, they held a press conference trying to obtain foreign investment in East Turkestan. And one of the questions asked was, is there any problems of violence, etc., that are happening in East Turkestan? And the Chinese Communist Party secretary at that time, Wang Luchen, stated, no, absolutely not. It's very peaceful here. There's no problems. We don't have any problems with terrorism, anything like that. 9/11 happened. The next day, China immediately claimed that it was a victim of East Turkestani terrorism. In November 12th is a very symbolic day for us because it's the day that we declared independence, but both in 1933 and 1944, China submitted a petition to the UN Security Council stating that they were victims of East Turkestani terrorism led by the so-called East Turkestan Islamic Movement, which there is no evidence of that group or any movement by that name existing prior to that date. And in turn, China spun that around to our people in East Turkestan, saying that the UN sees East Turkestan independence movement as a terrorist movement.
Oh, so they just use ETIM and it's like Islamic and independence were switched, while depending on the context.
Exactly. And if you look at China's sincerity, if they're really fighting against terrorism, why are they engaging in deals with the Taliban? Why are they? Why did they buy, you know, Tomahawk cruise missiles from Osama bin Laden? Why did they, you know, use Huawei to transfer, you know, technology to the Taliban even after the UN had banned, sanctioned, the Taliban? Why is this? You have to look at that. If you look at the current issue here in Pakistan, you know, China supports various Pakistani terrorists, including I think his name was Masood.
Yeah, Masood Azhar. Yeah.
Yeah, Masood Azhar. Preventing the UN Security Council numerous times from labeling him, you know, sanctioning him as an international terrorist. That's China's duplicity on its, you know, so-called war on terror. China's not engaging in a war on terror. In fact, the same PLA colonel that I mentioned earlier in his lecture, he stated that, you know, if it hadn't been for Osama bin Laden, if Osama bin Laden hadn't kept America busy, China would have not been able to develop like this. And he states that we should praise him, we should thank him, and he even called him Comrade bin Laden, saying that if it was up to him, he would have invited him to the 2008 Beijing Olympics.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Obviously, given the Chinese intentions with Pakistan, that is something which is well known to us in India. But just that we were not aware that the East Turkestan story was a complete fabrication. So yeah, absolutely. That's a great thing to know. Now, thank you for that. Like, this was really enlightening, Saleh. So now moving to when the government forms, let's say when the East Turkestan government forms in reality, what will be your first needs?
Please continue.
So yeah, what will be the military and foreign relations policy after that? Just based on like an early republic that you will have. What are your priorities in that case?
Our first priorities is maintaining our defense, maintaining our sovereignty, protecting our country. So we would need, you know, military assistance from countries like India, the United States, Europe, in terms of equipment, training, and even political, assistance and diplomatic assistance in terms of, you know, creating a formal diplomatic corps, and opening up embassies, consulates across the world. And this can already start right now. It doesn't have to wait until East Turkestan, you know, becomes an independent country. We can start preparations now by offering, you know, scholarships, grants that governments like the United States, India can do is by educating future Uyghur diplomats, future Uyghur intelligence officials, government officials in the fields of economics, political science, international relations, national security, intelligence, law, and many other fields. Even to the possibility to even, you know, in India, there's a Tibetan, the Tibetan regiment or Tibetan corps made up primarily of Tibetan soldiers. And yeah, that's something that that India could very well do with Uyghurs as well to maintain, if not a large, but at least a small group of, several hundred, maybe several thousand Uyghurs to, you know, help protect India's borders at the moment, while also, you know, setting up the stage for them to become the future, leaders of the East Turkestan military in the future. As far as our geopolitical and, military and foreign policy, again, as I mentioned earlier, our most important most important thing that we would do is maintain close ties, both militarily, politically, and economically with India. We would need India's, because it's logistically much efficient for India to help us in this realm by providing us with military training, maybe even creating, a mutual defense pact in which, if anything If India is attacked, we assist them. If East Turkestan is attacked, India assists us, likewise with Central Asian republics as well. And if we can even get NATO to do something like that, that would be great too. Establishing, you know, joint military bases in East Turkestan in crucial areas, especially the areas bordering China.
Mm-hmm. What would you expect from the Central Asian republics?
So as far as the Central Asian republics, I mean, we would expect them to, you know, work with other countries, you know, in preparation, you know, in time when the time comes for our independence, to help facilitate, you know, the transfer of our people and our diaspora communities back into East Turkestan, while also, you know, transfer of military support, aid, and all the other things that they can help us with, you know, providing us a little bit of, and this goes also as well to India, providing us, mm-hmm. you know, advisors to advise our government, both at the micro and macro level, to help make sure that we are not going to become a weak state.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. Although I do have criticism for the Indian government to be a weak state, but I think we are talking of different levels here. Sounds good. Like, this is really useful. Now, just coming to the last point, and this is something which is a really tricky topic for pretty much everyone. So how do you plan to maintain inclusivity in the system? It's like, as we have observed, like, whenever whichever place has a large amount of resources, typically, we have seen extractive systems develop. Like, for example, Venezuela is an extreme example. Or an inclusive example would be Canada or Norway with high resource availability. So I personally believe that a democratic republic is there to serve the people. Therefore, it has to be economically and politically inclusive as much as possible. So how do you plan to approach that?
So in terms of that, as you just mentioned, you know, Canada and Norway, you know, they have a very good system in place. I think they have a sovereign wealth fund that helps contribute to, you know, all their natural resources, all the money, the wealth that comes from it is put into a sovereign wealth fund, which will essentially, you know, be used in cases of emergency. Let's say there's an economic crisis, you will have, you know, money to sustain your government, to sustain your country. In the event of, you know, conflict, you won't have to, you know, go to international creditors and beg them for money, which is a very unfortunate state for most countries. Most countries have to take loans. And that's something that we want to do, is we want to be a debt-free country, while at the same time, part of that, you know, the wealth, that comes from, you know, the natural resources and other mineral resources that are in East Turkestan. I think we can use that to ensure that everyone has, you know, free health insurance for everyone, regardless of their age, whether they're sick or not, regardless of their ethnicity. Another thing is to ensure that everyone has access to education, and I'm not talking about education from kindergarten to, you know, up to 12th grade, but also at least the first 4 years, to where people can at least get a bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm. Awesome, that sounds really good. Anything else you have in mind that you would like, at least for example, the Indian people to hear?
So in the Indian people, you know, East Turkestan has a long history with India. As I mentioned before, we've never had any, you know, conflicts with India in our history of thousands of years of cultural and economic exchanges. The Indian government needs to realize that to maintain, you know, the economic growth of India and to ensure its own national security in the future, India needs to come to a real solution over this border conflict that's been ongoing for decades with the Chinese communists with China, by helping East Turkestan regain its independence, by helping Tibet regain its independence, which will eliminate, you know, the China problem. And that automatically will diminish the threat that Pakistan and its terrorist proxies pose to India, because without China, Pakistan is a very weak state, and it already is.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Thank you so much for being on Chinese Whispers. This was really insightful, and I hope everything you say turns out to be true. And my best wishes are for you, Saleh.
Thank you.